Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to another weekend bonus episode of the Tech Meme Ride Home. I'm Brian McCullough. For a while now, I've been trying to get someone to come on here to talk to me about big tech and regulation, big tech and antitrust. Well, Matt Stoller is a fellow at the Open Markets Institute. He's writing a book on the history of monopoly power, and he has direct experience with this stuff. He was a senior policy advisor and budget analyst to the Senate Budget Committee. He also worked in the U.S. House of Representatives on financial services policy, including Dodd-Frank, including the Federal Reserve and the foreclosure crisis. So today we're going to talk to Matt about monopoly power and big tech, how it's different because it's big tech, and regulating big tech. Is it different this time? Is some meaningful monopoly hammer about to come down on Silicon Valley? Quick note, I argue both sides of several arguments in this conversation, but I want to stress I don't have actually any solid conclusions about any of this myself. That's why I wanted to talk to someone like Matt to help me get my mind around this stuff. Please enjoy. You have experience in the government with things like oversight and regulation. I think, with the Senate, with the House of Representatives. On financial services policy, all sorts of stuff like that. But I guess my first question is, from you reading your tea leaves, is it really different this time for tech? Do you feel like there's going to be some meaningful action coming down the pike for big tech, or is this just a lot of hot air that will never amount to anything?
Oh, I think there's going to be meaningful action. So, and I think it's going to be soon. I think there's going to be a lot of it, and I think you actually already see some of it.
Like some of those, there was that bill, that bipartisan bill that got announced earlier this week?
So there's that. There's a bunch of stuff going on in the U.S. I think you're going to see at a state level, like state attorneys general are going to do some, are going to actually launch suits. But you're already seeing some with the Sprint T-Mobile merger, which is not big tech, but is a telecom network. And I think it's quite easy to move from telecom networks to big tech. And you're seeing a lot of interest among state attorney generals, state's attorneys general to deal with big tech, particularly on the Republican states. But then if you look abroad, like what you're seeing Germany do with Facebook is very important. And I think Australia is going to act. And you're going to see, like, the European Commission has been, you know, moderately interesting in what they've tried. So, you know, there are investigations in Japan, there are investigations in Israel. The India has actually forced the structural separation of Amazon from its marketplace, from its retail operation. So, you know, there's already things going on. It's just that if you look at a federal level in the United States, that's kind of an anomaly because there's not much going on. And the other thing, the other place to look is Congress, and in particular the House Antitrust Subcommittee, where there is a real investigation of big tech happening. And you know, so what's happening right now is that you got a lot of companies that are frustrated with Google, Facebook, and Amazon, and Apple, and they're going to the DOJ, they're going to the FTC, they're saying, "Here's my case, here's the problem," and then they're marching right down the street to Congress and saying, "Here's what I just told the DOJ and FTC." And since the head of that committee, David Cicilline, is pretty aggressive, I don't think it's too hard for the enforcers to realize that they now have somebody looking over their shoulder who wants them to act.
You know, you've been writing a lot about the history of how this has evolved, and I want to get into that. But actually, let me bring it back specifically just to the U.S., maybe because it's easier to frame it that way. What's changed? I was talking to somebody over the weekend because I remember, like, in the early 90s, there were these congressional hearings over cable TV prices. And if it was like, because it was a win-win politically, like, just you could show voters that politicians could do things that impacted people's daily lives. And so when I see, like, I think I said this on the show, like, when was the last time you could see something that both sides of the political divide could agree on? So is it, what has changed in the sense that, like, this is something that is a winning political issue legislatively, congressionally, that sort of thing?
Well, I think you saw it a couple weeks ago. So a number of things. So first of all, a couple weeks ago, there was in the House Antitrust Subcommittee, they did a hearing on newspapers and big tech, right? So concentration in advertising markets. And the witnesses, there was one guy from Big Tech Trade Association, and there was someone from the Atlantic Journal Constitution, there was someone from News Corp, there was someone from Open Markets, which is where I work, and there was someone who runs the newspaper lobby. And pretty much everybody except the guy from the internet, the big tech giants, was saying, hey, we have a concentration problem here. And both the Democrats and the Republicans that were doing oversight and that were at the hearing were agreed there is a concentration problem here. So that's the one place that you have Jerry Nadler and Doug Collins, who are, that's the chair and the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, that are at odds over Trump and judiciary and immigration, all of these high-profile polarizing issues. Well, they do come together on the Antitrust Subcommittee. And it isn't just about big tech. So they came together and they passed a bunch of bills out unanimously on pharmaceutical prices and concentration. And that the bills were co-sponsored each by a Republican and a Democrat. So you're seeing it there. And then you saw, you're seeing anger at monopolization among defense contractors. So you saw there's this one monopoly called TransDigm, and there was a hearing relatively recently over how TransDigm is gouging the Pentagon over essentially sole source monopoly aerospace parts. And there was a lot of anger from both sides of the aisle, and TransDigm voluntarily returned $60 million in overcharges. You're going to probably see, you saw an amendment adopted unanimously to allow Pentagon contracting officials to see cost information. You've seen things in the securities markets. So the stock exchanges are charging too much money for data, and the SEC recently put a cap on what they could charge or refused to allow them to raise prices. And that was something that both the Republicans and the Democrats voted for. So, you know, there are a lot of partisan fights over corporate power, but there's also if you actually are looking behind the heated rhetoric around Trump and around politics, there's already quite a bit of agreement and increasing agreement about the problems that we have in our political economy due to concentration.
All right. Well, that makes me want to ask, how much of this is game recognizes game? Because you wrote that, like, monopolies are basically private governments and have governing power. So we'll come back to tech specifically in a second. But if this whole move towards against monopolies and the new antitrust, how much of it is just about the power in governments around the world recognizing that their power is being usurped?
Well, I don't think that's really what's happening. I think to some extent you have, you're talking about sort of bureaucratic jealousy. And I think it's very tempting to see the world that way, but I think that there's a general, like, philosophical revolution going on about the role of government and the role of business and what being a citizen in a democratic culture means. So really for like the last 40 years, there's been this kind of argument that what we really need to make a good society is we need to make sure that consumers are getting as much as they can inexpensively. And that the way they get it is not that important. So if there's concentrations of power that are delivering them low prices and lots of stuff, cool, right? Like, I don't care if it's a mom and pop store or if it's Walmart. What matters is that the stuff is cheap. And That's a philosophy. It's a philosophy about how we see the world and how we relate to one another. And it's a philosophy that overlooks power. And it's also a way of embedding the ability to concentrate power in our laws and our rules, and moving decisions away from politicians and elected officials and business people and towards a very narrow group of economists who can kind of measure things in a sort of quasi, in a pseudo-scientific way. And that really dominated until, and this was global too. So you saw this kind of sense, oh, well, you know, China, we want to integrate them into the global system because, you know, they'll get McDonald's and Xboxes and then they won't want to go to war. And, you know, that's, so that's how we'll turn them into a democracy. We'll get them McDonald's and Xboxes. And what we're really seeing, what we've seen since the financial crisis and is a kind of discrediting of that way of thinking about the world. And big tech is, you know, a very obvious problem. Like, it's very obvious that they're accumulating sovereign power, but really learning to see power again, whether that power is in a pharmaceutical market or an agricultural market or in geopolitics through trading relationships with China, learning to see power again, political power, and learning to see ourselves not just as consumers, but also as producers and as citizens and as community members and as people who operate within markets. That's really what's happening. That's the revolution. It's not so much that like governments are getting jealous. It's more that everybody's recognizing, oh, wait a second, the kind of skepticism we have towards government, which is like the basic kind of libertarian way of making sure that, you know, consumers have low prices. That skepticism it now should be applied to the concentrations of power that we've allowed to accumulate, which happen to be in the private sector, but are not solely the private sector. I mean, I think China is a concentration of power, and that is a sovereign state.
I'm going to a big AI startup demo day here in the city tomorrow, and I will 100% be decked out in Mack Weldon clothing. Why? Well, Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. That's their AirKnit underwear. Crazy, comfortable, but elevated sweatpants, the Ace Collection. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads, the Silver Peak Polo. That's my personal fave. And ultra-soft antimicrobial tees for when you need to stay fresh longer. Their silver crewneck t-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code RIDE. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code RIDE. When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity, but user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months, or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride.
To bring it back specifically to Silicon Valley, you've written about how Silicon Valley, in a way, was actually born out of anti-monopoly. So that in a way, tech's modern tech's embrace of monopoly is sort of a betrayal of its roots?
That's right. I mean, so for, like, if you look at America, right, it's part of, it was America, American Revolution, 1776, same year Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations is published. And The Wealth of Nations is all about markets, but more importantly, how the opponent of markets is and political freedom are monopolies, right? So there's a ton of stuff in there about how bad the East India Company is. And, you know, the American Revolution is set off by a Tea Party rebellion against the East India Company. It is not about taxes. It was about how tax policy was used to monopolize tea markets. And so in a very real way, the American experiment was born out of a rebellion against monopoly. And you see this kind of, you know, there was Thomas Jefferson wanted to put an anti-monopoly provision in the Constitution. There was tremendous fear. There were fights over banking power very early on. The First National Bank, Andrew Jackson, the Second National Bank, there were fights over, you know, the railroads and telegraphs and the, you know, steel companies, oil companies, even the Civil War, you know, there was a tremendous fear of concentration of land, in what they called the slave power. And then you roll that forward, the fear of concentrated power, you know, you roll that forward in the automobile, chemical industry, radio, television, and then even into the 60s and 70s with computers.
Let me interrupt you there, because I want to do this in reverse chronological order, because I've argued before that the reason that, you know, 8 of the 10 most valuable companies in the world are tech companies is because there was that Microsoft antitrust that sort of hobbled them and allowed the Googles and the Facebooks to rise without being taken out. And then you go again back further, then you have the whole multi-decade IBM antitrust thing. But, like, literally the birth of the transistor, the semiconductor industry, happened because AT&T was forced to open up, like, their patent portfolio and things like that. I'm going to ramble a bit, but I'm getting to a point that I feel like you've made too at some degree. In fact, actually, I'm going to quote you. What worries me is that we're in a state with these tech companies where any halfway good product or you know, feature gets immediately snapped up by major platforms, any company, right? And it's just added to their utility belt of the feature sets of these big platforms. Like you wrote about how Google buys like a company a week and then shuts down any product that doesn't get to 100 million users or something. You wrote, and I'm quoting now, "Surely Google is creating cool technology, but is that technology really being developed, or is it being locked away as patents were in AT&T's 1956 vaults before the government stepped in?" From my perspective, from the Silicon Valley, from the tech perspective, is that something that needs to be remedied now, and can that be remedied?
Yes, I mean it's really the changeover to a world where, you know, people try to monopolize happened in roughly 1980-81. That's when you saw the development of the patenting of, or the copywriting of software, the copywriting of genetics, and the and then the change in antitrust priorities. And that's when this new digital technology, personal computer and the internet, was monopolized or started being monopolized. And the first one was Microsoft, and then Apple, and then eventually in the 1990s and 2000s, as Microsoft was pushed back, you have Amazon, Google, and Facebook. And these are companies which are competing over markets. They're trying to control the market. The winner wins the market, as opposed to competing within markets. And because of that, you have, you know, the goal is to prevent the emergence of new technologies. Once mm-hmm. you own a market, mm-hmm. you wanna like either control the next technology or prevent it from developing. And that's why, you know, the Microsoft case in the 90s was about, you know, they were developing the Internet Explorer browser for free, and they were also developing competition with Sun's Java tools. And both of those were what were called middleware. So Netscape wanted to be able to basically get around Microsoft's operating system by turning the browser into an operating system, similar to what you see with Chromebooks.
But the applicable thing is that, look, Expedia was birthed by Microsoft. If Microsoft was not going through the antitrust stuff in 98, 99, 2000, they would have bought Amazon. Especially after the dot-com bubble burst, there was no one left standing. Amazon was a $5 stock. They totally would have done that. So, like, it's sort of like that sort of window where even if the actual remedies didn't happen, the actual suit didn't go through and things like that, but they were hobbled and prevented from being predatory.
Right. I mean, they brought a bunch of venture capitalists into a room one day and they said, hey, here are the places that we're going to invest online and here are the places we're not going to invest. You know, make your investments accordingly, right? I mean, it was like, it was nice investment there. You got there, you know, shame if anything should happen to it. And that's eventually when the feds came in and said, we're going to, you know, litigate. It caused Microsoft to back off. And then a lot of people could get through Internet Explorer and bring their wares to market, as opposed to Microsoft always having a threat. Like Google right now has a threat. You know, if you want to get to the internet, you have to get through Google or Facebook, and they can just choke you off if they want to right now. And Microsoft could have done that. And you're right. The fact that they weren't able to do that is because there was an antitrust suit. The same thing with IBM in the 1970s, the same thing with a whole bunch of other companies like RCA and Xerox and AT&T, the same thing back in the 1880s and 90s with railroads and steel and oil. And so it's like, and you know, there's a reason. It's always the new technology that's the most valuable monopoly in the world, because the new technology is what's growing. You have pricing power. You know, the new technology changes all of the old technology. So you're seeing the same things happen again and again and again. And the goal of our anti-monopoly laws is to prevent the creation of wealth by controlling a bottleneck, and to encourage the creation of wealth by actually producing better goods and services. So to get rid of bottlenecks to the extent that it's possible.
To what degree then is the remedy, and I'm not arguing for this, but I'm saying taking the devil's advocate point. So to what degree is the remedy simply, it's almost like there was like a 30-year free-for-all for tech companies. Like no one scrutinized any acquisitions or anything. Like, so is that the simplest remedy, is to at the very least stop unfettered rapacious acquisitions, and then maybe even unwind some acquisitions?
I think that's right. I mean there isn't one solution, right? Because it's like the question is, how do you restore markets and democracy, right? So there are lots of different markets and they each need to be treated differently because they have different physical and technical characteristics. But the basic idea is, yeah, if you're a monopoly, you shouldn't be able to acquire other companies to move into other markets or to protect your monopoly, right? And Microsoft, for instance, tried to buy Intuit, which makes, you know, QuickBooks software in the 1990s, and the DOJ actually stopped, and that was their first antitrust loss. And, you know, so you shouldn't allow Google and Facebook and Amazon and Apple and Microsoft to buy companies, right? Because what that will do is it will force venture capitalists to put money into companies to compete with these guys, instead of putting money into companies that can get bought off, you know, bought out by.
Right. As soon as you have a good idea, you get kneecapped and you never get to find out if that good feature can turn into a good company.
Right. And then there's a lot of venture capitalists who are like, well, I think your idea is a good one and can maybe beat Google at certain things. But if I put money into you, then my other portfolio companies that I'm hoping to sell to Google, I won't be able to sell them to Google, right? So there's a kind of cartel arrangement or quasi-cartel arrangement that's happening, almost like, you know, the gangsterification of American business, but it's a very polite form of gangsterification.
Mm. Well, that's the definition of an oligopoly or a cartel. All right, let me argue the other side. If software is eating the world, the famous phrase, you know, do we have to redefine what it means? Because, like, okay, tech companies are literally right now taking over Hollywood because they have the distribution. Like, Apple might get into self-driving cars. You know what I mean? Like, so is the reality that if you're good at software, this magical sort of stack of you know, the product layer, you can deploy your skills into almost any market. And so is that necessarily wrong? Like, are you suggesting that we just have to keep everyone in their own lanes? But is that even possible if it's like, well, but if you can do a better car via software, like, why should we stop you?
Okay, well, so you want to talk about Hollywood or you want to talk about cars?
You pick.
Okay. Well, I'll pick Hollywood then. Okay, so we'll talk about Hollywood, right? Hollywood, you know, and culture and ideas, right? Like, what you want to do with any with a movie industry is that you want to encourage people to make good art that they can sell that's popular, right? And you want to put as few limits on that as possible and allow as much distribution as possible so that you can't have censorship, right? And the way that we've done that historically, and we've done it through regulation of television networks, very important regulations called financial syndication rules in the 70s. We've also done it through antitrust suits. There's a wave of suits in the 1940s to break the studio system.
They couldn't own the theaters, right?
Right, and they could do block booking and a whole bunch of other things. What we basically did is we separated out production and distribution, right? And so if you distribute, you can't produce, and you have to have competitors in distribution. Mm-hmm. And if you produce, you can't distribute, and you have to have competitors in production. And what that does is it creates the maximum amount of freedom for the artist and allows for local control of theaters and local control of distribution. There's a whole lot of reasons why that's a good thing. But what you're seeing now is increasingly it's the distributors who are concentrating power, whether that's in the hands of like a very, very small number of companies that own theaters. There's incredible concentration in the theater market. And then you're seeing incredible concentration in distribution markets through like things like Netflix and Amazon, neither of which, by the way, actually have to make money, both of whom are losing money to acquire distribution power. And, you know, the problem with that model is that if you are just good at making movies, you're an artist, it's very hard for you to start a business making movies because you're competing against people who don't have to make money. And that's So I can't compete against somebody, no matter how good my product is. If I have to make money and somebody else doesn't, they're going to win, right? And so that's the problem. That's why you want to separate. You don't want to allow the acquisition of market power to be the goal. You want to force the creation of goods and services and distribution networks that are efficient and do a better job to be the goal of competition.
You know, I want to ask you about Libra and all that good stuff, but you know what? I feel like I might need to talk to you again. So at the very least, do you want to plug anything? Like, I think you have a book coming out later this year about monopoly power and democracy and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So two things. So one, I have a book coming out. It's called Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. It's coming out in October. So you'll have to wait a little bit. It's really good. It's fun. It's a completely different view of the 20th century history. And it's got protests. It's got, you know, political fights. It's got businessy stuff. It's really a fun read. Lots of history. I was very, very exciting for me to discover all of it in the archives. And impeachment, it's just so fun. And the other thing is, I started an email newsletter. I call that, it's called Big. And you can go to mattstoller.com.
Big, that's big, B-I-G. And by the way, I will double plus endorse this newsletter.
Oh, thank you. Anyway, I'm trying the email newsletter thing just to try to explain to people like the lost history of anti-monopolism and democracy and innovation. So,
yeah, and listen, again, we're both short on time, but I feel like there would be more to talk about. So hopefully you'll come on again. Thank you so much, Matt.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.